Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Econ 100B. My name is Stephen Wood, and I'm the instructor for this course. So I hope you're all here for 100B. Econ, macroeconomics. Woohoo! Yes, so that's what we're here for. So just to let you know what this course is all about, this is an intermediate macro level course, right? So I'm assuming you've all had principles of economics somewhere where you at least had some basic introduction to macroeconomics. So we're going to do a couple of things in the course. One is, like most economics classes that you will take, we are going to develop a whole bunch of models, right? So there is no grand unified theory of macroeconomics, so there's no single model that explains all. So we will have a number of different models that we will be developing over the course of the term. And each of those models will actually be developed to answer a very specific question. The questions will be different, models will be different, but those models will be useful for answering the particular questions that we're talking about. Once we've developed those models, which will now help us to explain some significant macroeconomic variables, we're going to use those models to try to explain things that have happened in the past, whether it be very rapid economic growth or slow growth or recessions or economic booms or high rates of inflation or low rates of inflation, whatever it might be. But we also want to use those models to try and explain what's going on currently, so you can make some sense of the economic and political news that keeps coming out about what's going on in the economy and what we should do about it. And finally, we might even want to use those models to make some sort of projections or predictions about what would happen under certain circumstances. So if we were to do such and such with the government budget, what do we think the implications of that would be? Or if the Federal Reserve was to decide to end quantitative easing right now, what would the implications of that be? Of course, you might be asking yourself, I don't know what quantitative easing is, so the question might be moot, but we'll get there. Okay? So develop the models, but also apply them to real-world existing problems and issues. So today, we just want to talk about some of the big introductory types of issues that one normally talks about on the first day of class. So we'll talk about what macro really is all about, what some of the key features are, why macroeconomics is so controversial. It's mostly because people won't listen to me. What economic policies we have and why we use those. Take a quick look at the Great Recession and the recovery that we've had since then. So the Great Recession is the name that we give to the recession that occurred in 2008 and the first half of 2009. Then at the end, I'll make a few comments about the syllabus, but hopefully you've all seen a copy of the syllabus, which is posted on BSpace, and I hope everything is very clear there. But let's talk a little bit about macroeconomics. Right? So macro, it comes from the Greek, and it means large or big. So macroeconomics is really the big picture of what's going on in the economy. And in this sense, when we talk about the economy, we typically mean the national economy, right? So when we think about macroeconomics, we're generally thinking about the aggregate economic activities that are taking place at the national level. Okay? More specifically, we'll be talking about how that economic activity is structured. That is, how economic variables are related one to another, the dynamic adjustment of the economy. So when one variable changes, how does that affect other variables? Not only in the current time period, but also through time. So if something happens today, other things will also happen today, but guess what? Some other things are going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, next year from those events that occur today. So that's what we refer to when we talk about the dynamic adjustment of the economy. And finally, we'll also talk about the performance of national economies. Now, in order to talk about the performance of national economies, we have to have some benchmark. Right? So as an example, the economy since the middle of 2009 has been growing. It's been growing at an average annual rate of about 2%, 2.1%. Good, bad, indifferent. The unemployment rate has been falling. It reached a peak of 9.9. Now it's down to 6.8. Great news, right? Or not, right? In order to know, we have to have some idea of what a benchmark, a good benchmark, would be. Is the unemployment rate at 6.8 still too high? Or could it be too low? Or maybe it's just right. Okay? So we have to have those benchmarks in order to have some sort of idea of judging the performance of the national economies. And then the other thing that macroeconomics deals a lot with is the government policies that are used to influence macroeconomic events. Government spending, government tax rates, changes in the central bank's target interest rate, or changes in the size of the central bank's balance sheet. So all of those types of government policies also have an influence on the overall economy. And we'll want to look at why or how that works, what those linkages are. And we'll also discuss a little bit as we go through the course why some of those things are fairly controversial and whether we want to think about them in alternative ways. When we get right down to the basics, macroeconomics really involves only four big questions or four big issues that we look at. The first is long-term economic growth. How fast can an economy grow on average over an extended period of time? That's really what the question is all about. The second question or issue is short-run business fluctuations. When we look at economies, one of the things that we see is their growth rates are up and down. Sometimes they're positive, sometimes they're negative. This is often referred to as the business cycle. So why does that happen? Why do we have booms and busts? Is there anything we could do about them? Maybe, maybe not. But those are the types of things that we might be interested in. Employment and unemployment. How many people are working? How many people aren't working but would like to have a job? What's the implication of low levels of employment or high unemployment or vice versa? How is employment and unemployment related to economic output, either in the short run or in the long run? Those are also important issues. And finally, inflation. How fast are prices changing? So these are the four big issues. Now notice the first two of these issues, long-run economic growth and short-run business fluctuations, have to do with how much the economy is producing. Think about that as quantity. And inflation has to do with how fast prices are changing. So we can think about that as prices. Now, if you remember your very simple supply and demand diagrams, price on the vertical axis, quantity produced on the horizontal axis, that's exactly what we have in macro. We still have quantity produced on the horizontal axis. It just turns out that it's the aggregate amount that's being produced in the entire economy. And we still have something that looks like prices on the vertical axis. It's not really prices, but it's the change, or rate of change of prices. And therefore, what we deal with in macroeconomics will actually look a bit like our basic supply and demand curve. We'll talk about why it's not just an aggregation of supply and demand curves later, but that'll get us started. So let's look at each of these in a little more detail. When we think about long-term economic growth, we actually have to think about two things. How much output is being produced, which we measure through real gross domestic product, or GDP, which we'll talk about in more detail on Thursday. Right? So this is our measure of aggregate economic output in the economy. But in the long run, the other thing that we have to recognize is most countries, most of the time, have growing populations. And that growing population means that they have more potential workers. So obviously, having more potential workers suggests that you should be able to produce more. So if we're looking at a long enough time period, we want to make sure that we adjust output for the number of workers that we have. So when we think about long-term economic growth, we look at it in terms of real GDP per person or per capita. So here's a picture of real GDP per person in the United States in inflation-adjusted terms from 1950 up to 2012. And so what you can see is back in the early, mid-1950s, real GDP per capita was roughly $15,000 per person. And today, it's just shy of $50,000 per person. First thing to notice about this diagram is over that long time period, we've seen an upward trend. This is good, right? One way of thinking about economic output per person is this is one way to measure material standards of living, right? Production is what we're producing, real GDP, which also gives us what we can consume. So we can think about our consumption per person as being correlated with economic output per person. Now, this isn't the only measure of economic welfare, and it may not even be the best measure of economic welfare. And there are lots of different kinds of welfares other than economic welfare that we might want to consider. But this does give us one measure of our material standards of living. So again, notice that we have a long improving trend there on average. Good. Now, that improving trend for the United States has been about 2% per year. Right? So economic output is growing faster than the population by roughly 2% per year. Over a long period of time, you can see it's made a significant difference. The second thing to notice about this is in these areas that I've shaded that have these little gray bars in them, these, by the way, are periods of time that we call recessions, where economic output, real GDP, is declining. So real GDP is declining, but again, most countries have rising populations, so real GDP per person is going to decline even more. So as we look at this, during these recessionary periods, we can see that real GDP per person declines. Some of these recessions are, it's more obvious than in others, but it's there in every single case. Again, that also reflects that kind of business cycle or short-run business fluctuations approach. So one of the questions that we're going to ask ourselves is, what is it that an economy can do or has done that accounts for the fact that we can end up with rising real GDP per person? Second question we might ask ourselves is, this is the picture of the United States, where the increase has been about 2% per year since 1960. If we looked at the same information for China, what we would have seen since the 50s to about 1985 is a very, very, very gradual increase. I mean, less than 1%. Less, I think, if I remember my numbers right, slightly less than 0.5%. But since the late 1980s and early 1990s, in China, this has been growing at about an 8% rate, much, much faster. Two questions jump to my mind when I think about that data. What did China do in the late 80s and early 90s to bend that curve so that economic output per person was started to grow much, much more quickly? The second thing that it brings to my mind is, what is it that China did that we in the United States might be able to do to accelerate our growth rate? Is there anything that we can do? Or is there something unique about what China has experienced? Might be helpful to know that. Okay, when we think about short-run business fluctuations, we're typically talking about a period of time of a year or two or three. In a short-term time period like that, we don't really have to worry too much about changes in population. Again, in a short-term period of a couple of years, most countries' populations don't change very significantly. Therefore, we don't have to worry about the per capita side. We can just look at aggregate economic output. And we can look at those periods of time where output is growing in those periods of time where it's shrinking. Economic expansions versus recessions. Just simply looking at real GDP. Well, this is a look at real GDP. However, this is not the level of real GDP, but rather the growth rate of real GDP over the course of a year. In the United States, we measure GDP on a quarterly basis. So what this really shows is how much economic output we have in any given quarter relative to what it was four quarters or 1 year previously. Now, the first thing to notice is if the gray areas are recessions where economic output is falling, the white areas must be periods of economic expansion. And we have a lot more economic expansion than we do recessions. So, which correlates with what we saw in our first diagram. Over long periods of time, the economy is growing. The second thing to notice is even when we have positive growth rates, the growth rates are really volatile. Boy, they're bouncing around all over the place. Not only are they bouncing around all over the place, the volatility, I don't want to say magically, but starting in about 1985, if you looked at the volatility of the quarterly GDP numbers, you would see that they're much less after 1985 than they were before 1985. Which might make you wonder what the heck happened in the late 1970s or the early 1980s to mean that the economy would be less volatile today than it was previously. The final thing to note is that these recessions, gray bars, notice that the year-on-year growth rate, that's a slight negative, goes negative in almost every case. Didn't actually happen in the early 2000s, weird recession that we'll look at in more detail later. But then we might ask ourselves, okay, if we're going negative, that's not a good thing. What causes the economy to roll over like that? And if we could identify the causes, can we identify a solution? Is there something in terms of government policy that we could implement that would either make recessions milder or less frequent? Well, some people thought we knew how to do that, and we're very confident of our abilities until 2008. Because if you look at that, you'll see that that was the deepest recession in this time period. In fact, that is the sharpest decline in economic activity that the United States has experienced since 1937 and 1938. So we're talking about a long time period before we had seen anything that bad. Employment and unemployment. When you get right down to it, the study of economics is actually the study of people and how they engage in business and economic activity. So people, workers in particular, are critically important to how the economy works and how we would judge the performance of an economy, good, bad, or indifferent. And when we look at the labor market, we want to look at both the number of people who are employed as well as the number of people who are unemployed. Now, employed, pretty easy to figure out, right? Somebody has a job or they don't. If you've got a job, you're considered to be employed. We'll also look at the number of hours that people work on average. We'll look at the wage rate that they earn and so forth. Unemployed is a slightly more complicated concept. Not having a job is not synonymous with being unemployed. Not having a job, being willing and able to work, and to be actively looking for work. So we have three conditions, which we'll talk more about on Thursday or next Tuesday, are all required in order to be counted as unemployed. So my daughter is a stay-at-home mom. She's willing and able to work, but she's not looking for a job because she doesn't need one, right? So she's not employed, but she's also not considered to be unemployed. So the number of people who are unemployed is important because it tells us something about the size of the potential labor force, not just the people who have jobs, but the people who would like to have jobs as well. So this is one measure of employment called payroll employment. This is essentially the number of people who are hired as employees. So this particular measure does not count the self-employed individuals. And again, you can see that over time, as you probably know, the U.S. population continues to grow, and as you can see, the number of people employed continues to grow. Kind of looks like that GDP per capita. But remember, GDP per capita was output divided by population. So part of the increase in economic output is we have a larger workforce, but part of it must be due to something else, because output has to be growing faster than the population. Once again, we can see something that happens during recessions. Right? If economic activity is falling, business sales are falling. If sales are falling, businesses want to produce less. If businesses want to produce less, they need fewer workers. Employment always declines during a recession. If there is a strong argument for the government being involved in trying to minimize the effects of the recessions, this is the argument. It doesn't have anything to do with some weird idea about what real GDP is, because none of us have ever been able to see real GDP or touch real GDP or measure, well, we can measure it. But these are real people who are losing real jobs and losing real incomes that has real effects on families. So this is the real point of thinking about business cycles and what government can do about it. The other thing that we see during recessions is the unemployment rate always rises. So we can see these big increases in unemployment when we have these recessions. And then the unemployment rate begins to retreat once the economy begins to grow again. Now we also have to be careful when we talk about the unemployment rate, especially when we think about the performance of the economy. So if we were to look at 1982 as an example, the unemployment rate went to 10.3%. At the end of 2009, the unemployment rate was 9.9%. So on one sense, we might say the economy and the recession were much worse in the early 1980s than they were here in 2008 and 2009. But the reason we want to be careful with that assessment is to look at where the unemployment rate was when we started. In 1979, the unemployment rate was slightly below 6%. In 2007, the unemployment rate was 4.5%. The increase here is greater than the increase here. Again, suggesting that the last recession was indeed much more severe than the one we had in the early 1980s. Okay, the fourth big macro variable is inflation, and we worry a lot about inflation. Inflation is nothing more than how quickly the overall price level is rising. So two things that are important there. One is it's rising, right? So inflation means rising prices. But the overall price level is also important. When we talk about inflation at the macro level, we're not particularly concerned about the price of any individual good or service, or even any small group of goods and services. There are literally millions and millions of different goods and services that are produced and sold in the economy in a year. What we want to look at here is a weighted average price of all those goods and services being produced and sold. Right? So when we calculate this overall price index, it's just that. It's an index. It's a weighted average of all this stuff. And we want to see how rapidly it's moving up or down. So again, inflation, the term inflation means how fast are prices rising. Now, we also have a technical term known as disinflation. What disinflation means is that we do have inflation, prices are rising, but the rate at which they're rising is slowing. So a period of disinflation would be seeing inflation go from 8% to 6% to 4% to 3% to 2%. Notice prices are rising that entire period of time. They're simply rising at a slower and slower pace. So that's what we refer to as disinflation. Then two kind of anomalous periods that we often discuss are deflation and hyperinflation. Deflation is a period of time where the aggregate price level is actually falling. Average prices are declining. Now, I'm going to guess most of us would prefer to buy something on sale rather than pay full price for it, which makes it sound like deflation, where prices are falling, should be a good thing. After all, that's when we like to do the shopping. It turns out deflation is a really bad situation most of the time. There's one exception to that, but we don't see that very often. So countries do a lot to avoid trying to be in deflation. And if you find yourself in deflation, you generally want to do an awful lot. I mean, you want to do strenuous economic policy to get yourself out of it. The good news is deflation doesn't occur very often. The best modern example is Japan, which has been in deflation on and off for most of the last 15 years. They keep struggling to get out, and we'll look at what they're actually doing to get out later in the term. But it's also one of those things that's making the Japanese economy perform so poorly. At the other extreme from deflation is hyperinflation. Hyperinflation is a period of time when prices are rising very rapidly. There's no formal definition, but sort of the rule of thumb is that prices need to rise 50% per month or more. Now, just to put that in perspective, last year in the United States, inflation was under 2% for the entire year. So 50% or more per month. Again, hyperinflation is something that does not occur very often, but we've had some very notable examples of this. People think almost immediately of the German hyperinflation that occurred after World War I, where prices went up a gazillion percent. Or they think more recently of Zimbabwe in southern Africa, where in 2008 the inflation rate was 2 million percent per year. So think about your prices going up 2 million percent. The $1 trillion Zimbabwe note would not even buy one sheet of toilet tissue. So guess what $1 trillion Zimbabwe notes were used for? Okay. So what we'll see when we talk about hyperinflation later, it's also a very destructive, as you can probably imagine, economic situation to find yourself in. So we'll have to ask ourselves both why a country would find itself in that situation and, two, what you would do about it. Okay, so this is one measure of the general price level in the United States called the Consumer Price Index. So this is the prices, basically, of what people like you and I would buy, of the goods and services that you and I would buy. And I've actually got two different measures up here. The blue line is just our what we call the overall CPI, or Consumer Price Index. The red line actually extracts from that overall number the price changes that occur for food and energy. This is sometimes referred to as the core Consumer Price Index. Now, the core, we don't take food and energy prices out because we don't think that they're important. They're clearly important. Most American households spend somewhere between 25 and 30% of their budgets on food and energy. So that's obviously a very important price to to look at. The reason we extract it in this data series is because food and energy prices are very volatile. But the volatility generally doesn't have much trend to it. And so over time, the overall CPI, the blue line, closely tracks the CPI excluding food and energy, which would mean the red line. So notice here in 2008, big spike in oil prices. So overall inflation went up, but it was energy prices. If we took energy prices out, we didn't see much change. And later, in late 2008 and 2009, oil prices crashed. And inflation looked really, really low. But again, if you look at what happens to the core numbers, they came down a bit, but not very much. So if we're looking at inflation as a signal for what's happening in the economy or what monetary or fiscal policy should do, you would be swung all over the place by paying attention to inflation, including food and energy prices, and therefore you might actually generate a lot more economic volatility than you would otherwise. Okay, now, in macroeconomics, we have several key features that we need to think about. Macroeconomics, actually like all economics, is model-based. So we need to think about models and how models are built. The second thing about macroeconomics is we have aggregation. And aggregation both hides problems and creates problems. And finally, macroeconomics involves general equilibrium analysis. So when we think about models, we need to think about how we're going to use models to explain the economy. We start with simply an economic theory, which is simply an idea or set of ideas about how various economic variables are related to one another. How does the world work? It's that set of ideas that we're coming up with. Then we want to take that theory and translate it into a model. When we do so, we have to simplify what's taking place in the real world. As we'll discuss later, the macroeconomy is incredibly complex. We can't possibly try to explain every little wiggle and squirm that takes place. So our model is going to be somewhat simplified. Once we have kind of an issue, once we've decided what our relationship should be, we need to decide the difference between our exogenous variables and our endogenous variables. For every model that we develop this term, it will be very important that you can identify the endogenous variables from the exogenous variables. Endogenous variables are the variables that are whose movement we're interested in explaining. The model is going to tell us how those variables move or the values of those variables change given changes in other variables. The exogenous variables will be those whose values or changes in values will be taken as givens. Doesn't mean that they don't change, but we're not going to try to explain what causes those change. So let me give you a quick example. We typically think of tax rates as being an exogenous variable, sometimes called a policy variable, right? So how are tax rates determined? Well, the Congress gets mad at the administration gets mad at the Congress, they fight it out for a while, nothing happens for a while, and then they change them, right? So that seems to be the way it's worked recently anyway. So what we have then is tax rates being determined by a political system. But I defy you to try to find a consistent set of variables, economic or non-economic, that would actually help you to explain when and how much tax rates would change by. So if we can't explain them, we simply take them as exogenous variables. They are what they are. They change when they change. We want to find out how other variables change in response to changes in tax rates. So now let's think then about consumer spending. How would consumer spending change if there was a change in tax rates? Well, you may remember from Econ 1, something called a consumption function. If tax rates go up, disposable income would go down. With less spendable income, consumption would also go down. So you have an inverse relationship then between tax rates and consumer spending. Changes in tax rates, an exogenous variable, cause changes in consumer spending, an endogenous variable. So our endogenous variables are always those variables that we're most interested in explaining. So again, the easy way to develop a model, identify an interesting question, figure out what our endogenous variables are, right? What are we going to try to explain? Figure out our exogenous variables. What variables will be our explanatory ones? Figure out the relationship. What we mean there is this a linear, a nonlinear? Is this and is it a direct relationship or an inverse relationship? Those are things that we would like to think about before we do any statistical testing. Once we've got that, we want to look at the data, run it through all the statistical tests that we know, and see how it comes out. We need to evaluate the results. If they're not very good, do not pass go, do not collect $200, go back to Baltic Avenue and start all over again. Right? But if the results do come out fairly robust, now this tells us that we've got a model that we can probably use in a variety of different situations. We can use that model to explain the past, the current period, and perhaps even to make predictions about the future or to use it to make policy decisions. All the major policy makers have staffs that work with economic models to figure out what kind of policy they should be looking at. So this is a simplified schematic of what an economic model might look like. So we've got to know what those exogenous variables are. We run them into our hypothesized relationship, right? Our equations, our slopes and constants and all of those types of things, and out pops are the values of our endogenous variables. If we make a change over here, we'll get a change over here. Right? So change the exogenous variable, we should get a change in the endogenous variable. That's the relationship that we want to look at. Now, just to give you a heads up here, it's more complicated than this because the endogenous variable may come back in and change the value of a second endogenous variable. Almost all macroeconomic models have more than one equation. For that matter, so do most microeconomic models. So we really will end up dealing with systems of simultaneous equations. Hope that doesn't scare you, because it's not scary. Okay, so if our models are going to be useful, then several things need to happen. One is the assumptions that we made need to be reasonable. It's really hard to convince somebody that your model is correct if you use really off-the-wall assumptions. Right? The model's not going to be very valuable to anybody if it doesn't address a real-world problem. Right? So there has to be some applicability to it. Third, it has to be empirically verifiable. That is, do the data that we have available to us actually support the theory and the model that you've developed? And then, if it does, it should also be consistent with what's happening in the real world. So if we put in the actual values of the exogenous variables, we should get something very, very close to the actual values of the endogenous variables. And that then will tell us that we have a reasonably good model. A second major feature of macroeconomics is aggregation. Remember, we're talking about the national economy. Now, in the United States, the national economy is made up of 315 million individuals and 165 million households, tens of millions of businesses, hundreds of thousands of units of government, and a huge amount of interaction with foreign economic entities. So we're not looking to try and explain the behavior of every individual or every individual business. We're going to take their behaviors and add them all up, see what happens at the highly aggregated level. This is one of those things that distinguishes macroeconomics from microeconomics. Micro is very disaggregated, where macro is very highly aggregated. The problem with aggregation is you can lose a lot of information if you don't look a little bit deeper. Now, this data happens to be for the fourth quarter of 2012. GDP, which seems to be one of the variables we're particularly interested in, rose by only 0.1%. Now, if that was all the information that you have, you wouldn't be too excited about what was happening in the economy. But if you look one level down, you would see that consumer spending, business fixed investment, and imports were all pretty strong. This is actual spending that's taking place in the private side of the economy. The real weakness came from the government side and exports. Oh, yeah, there was that thing called the European economic crisis. So they didn't buy much of our stuff. And then a big drawdown on inventories. Businesses weren't going to add inventories if the economy was still fairly weak. So driving backwards or getting down into some of the disaggregation is still very important. Nevertheless, when we talk about consumption, we're talking about everybody's consumption added all up. The same with inventories, the same with government. We're not going to spread it down to each of the individual economic units. Finally, macroeconomics is general equilibrium analysis, right? We only have four economic agents. All consumers or households added together. All businesses and producers added together. All units of government added together. All foreign transactions added together, right? Four economic agents. Remember when in micro, when you studied the perfectly competitive firm, one of the things that you might remember is that perfectly competitive firm is what we call an atomistic firm. No matter how much it produced, or if it didn't produce anything at all, it wouldn't affect the market price. If it doesn't affect the market price, it won't have any effect on any other producer, and it won't have any effect on consumers. It's what we call partial equilibrium analysis. I can look at one microeconomic unit in isolation of everything else because we're assuming nothing else changes. But if there are only four people, four economic agents at the party, whatever one of them does is going to have an effect on the other three. And so this is where we get to the point where in macroeconomics, whatever happens, happens to everybody and their feedback effects. So everything depends on everything else. Okay, so why is macro so controversial? Well, the first reason is the economy is really, really complex, right? So I've already mentioned 315 million people, 165 million households, tens of millions of businesses, hundreds of thousands of governments, and untold thousands of foreign transactions, right? So you got a whole mess going on here. We can't examine all of those individual agents and see how they behave. Even looking at representative agents makes it very, very difficult and complex. So we're aggregating up from that, so we're going to miss a lot of information. The second thing is the economy is quite organic. It changes over time. So I noticed that lots of you have laptops or tablets in front of you. And guess what? Laptop computers have only been around for, 25, 30 years? I'm going to guess almost every one of you has a cell phone. You know, cell phones have only been in wide use for 15 or 20 years. Do you think that cell phones and laptop computers and the internet have changed the way the economy works and behaves? Because if you do, then you have to say that the economy today is definitely different than it was 20 years ago. let alone 30, 40, or 50 years ago. So if the economy's different, then we actually also have to ask ourselves, does that mean the relationship between variables is also changed? And the answer, of course, is yes. So when we try to describe the economy, we're not just trying to describe something that was built once and forever, and all we have to do is figure out the outlines and the internal workings of it. It is, as I mentioned, a living organism. We also have this general equilibrium problem that also makes it complex. Something changes, which causes further changes, which, by the way, feed back to the original changes. A second reason is the data are not very robust. So think about GDP. We have quarterly GDP from 1946 on. So let's just call that 70 years. I know it's not, but let's call it 70 because the arithmetic's easier, right? So quarterly data for 70 years means we have all of 280 observations on GDP. 280 observations, not very many. I used to do a lot of work for a hedge fund that was following prices in the stock market, and the bond market, foreign exchange market, and commodities markets. We used to collect 10,000 price observations per day, and we had 22 years of data. That's a robust data set. 280 observations in an economy that's changing over time, not very much. Right? So our data sets are not very robust. We don't have deep history. We definitely don't have many business cycles to look at, and we don't have the kind of detail that we would actually like to have. There are also some important theoretical differences about how the economy operates. So who can give me a brief synopsis of the article that I sent you, The Tale of Dueling Economists? Somebody raise your hand or I'll pick somebody at random. Yes, sir. Loudly. After World War I.
Whereas Hayek, after watching Austria after World War I, rise of Nazism, he said that all socialism and central planning is going to limit personal freedom.
Okay. So the thing I want to point out about this is these are two guys that came of age roughly the same era, right? Keynes is a bit older than Hayek was during this period of time. But the really defining events in both of their lives were World War I and its aftermath into the 1930s. So John Maynard Keynes was British. So he's looking around in Britain in the late 1920s and the early 1930s, and what he sees is unemployment in the 20% range. Inflation nowhere to be seen. Lots of idle businesses. That is, we've got machines that weren't being used. We've got workers that weren't being employed. And he looked around and he said, you know what? The government's not doing anything to try to resolve this situation. So the conclusion that he came to is we need to have more government involvement in the economy, especially when the economy is depressed, as it was in the early 1930s, in order to put these resources back to work. And therefore, he had advocated increases in government spending, reductions in taxes, in order to try to stimulate the private sector of the economy. Hayek, on the other hand, also went through World War I and the 1920s and the 1930s, but he had a very, very different experience. He was in Austria. And the Austrian economy and the German economy were very, very tightly linked in those days. And as you probably know, in the aftermath of World War I into the 1920s, Germany experienced very, very severe hyperinflation. So did Austria. And Hayek saw that his family's wealth completely wiped out. And so his conclusion was government had intervened too much. There were mistakes in government policy that caused this hyperinflation. And his conclusion then was, keep the government out of everything. Two people, same era, different experiences that they're seeing, high unemployment versus hyperinflation, come to two completely different conclusions about what should be, what the government should do. Defining events in a person's life, especially when they're relatively young, as you are, often set your worldview for the rest of your life. Now, I happen to have come out of college during a period of high inflation and high unemployment in the United States. So in my career, I've worried a lot about high unemployment and high inflation, not Austrian-type inflation, but most of my work has been involved in that area. People who are coming of age now, and especially those in graduate school now, we're going to spend a lot of time thinking about financial crises and what can be done to either minimize the damage from a financial crisis or to make financial crises much less likely. So where one thinks about some of these issues depends upon what some of the defining events are, typically early in one's life. Okay? Different structures of the economy is basically what Hayek and Keynes saw. Now, there's also a big issue about sensitivities of events. So let me give you an example of a microeconomic event that is in the news these days, not macro, but micro, right? So should we raise the minimum wage? Now, if you remember from microeconomics, if the government pushes the price above the market clearing price, what will happen is the quantity demanded for whatever that is going to be reduced. Right? And the quantity demanded in the labor market just happens to be the demand for workers. So if we've got less demand for workers because of a higher minimum wage, we're going to have more unemployment. Right? By the way, almost nobody disagrees with that statement. Key question is, how much more unemployment? If we raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour, $12 an hour, and unemployment goes up by 12,000 people, is that a lot? Is that not very much? What if it goes up by 1,000,002? Right? What's the sensitivity that's involved here? Remember, the data is not very robust, so we have a very difficult time actually having great confidence in what those sensitivities are. Fourth big reason that macro is controversial, we don't have any controlled experiments. So what I mean by that, think about the report that Professor Romer, Christina Romer, put out when before the Obama administration had been elected, but before they came into office. She put out a report that talked about, was arguing for a stimulus package. And in their report and in their simulations, they said, well, if the stimulus package passes, the unemployment rate will not rise above 8%. Well, I've already told you the unemployment rate went to 9.9%. So the opponents to the stimulus package said, aha, stimulus obviously did not work because the unemployment rate clearly rose above 8%. Okay, they're right on that. It did. The question, though, that we don't have the answer to is, what would have happened to the unemployment rate if we didn't pass the stimulus? Because all we know is what did happen. We don't know what the counterfactual is. We don't have that controlled experiment. Remember, in medical science, when they test drugs, they always have a placebo group. We don't have a placebo group. So you always have a group that you're trying to benchmark in when you're doing scientific research. We don't have that here. So all we have is counterfactuals. Counterfactuals are not very satisfying because it's basically an argument about something that you can't prove because it didn't happen. So this leads to lots of controversy, especially if different people think the structure of the economy is very different. Now, a fifth reason that macroeconomics is controversial is any policy that is taken in response to macroeconomic fluctuations has implications, right? Public policy implications. What does it mean if we're going to increase government spending, change taxes, have the central bank do something? All of that is going to have an effect on different people, some positive, some negative. There are no free lunches, right? There are very few Pareto optimal outcomes in life, and definitely none in macroeconomics. So we need to think about that. Now, one part of that is, what do we think the appropriate goals of macroeconomics are? Even if we think the government should be involved in doing stuff, what are we actually trying to achieve? So the Gallup poll just came out recently, and it pointed out, the question it asked was, what do you think the number one economic problem in the United States is? Number one answer is the unemployment rate's too high. Number two answer was the budget deficit's too high. Now, Keynes would argue that if you're worried about number one, you shouldn't be worried about number two. If you're worried about number two, you shouldn't be worried about number one. Because according to Keynes, reducing the government budget deficit would actually cause the economy to shrink and the unemployment rate to go up. For evidence, he would suggest, look at Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Italy, the UK. There are other countries, but that's enough. But there are other people who actually believe that if you shrink the government budget deficit, you have fiscal austerity that somehow, don't know exactly how this works, but somehow that's going to lead to an economic expansion. So depending upon how you think the economy works, you can have very different perspective on what our goals are. Then we also have to think about what's the appropriate role of policy variables. This is particularly true in terms of government spending. And we see this debate being played out in Washington, D.C. over the last number of years. What is the appropriate size and role for the federal government? That's the debate that's taking place right now. Some people want a much smaller government. Other people want a somewhat larger government. How do we work that out? There are macroeconomic implications of that. So that leads to discussions as well. And finally, we have differences in time horizons. So let me make two statements. If you want economic output to go up, consumers should spend more and save less. Now, second statement. If you want economic output to go up, consumers should save more and spend less. Those are just opposite statements, right? So one can be true, but both of them can't be true at the same time. But what if I said the following? In the short run, if you want economic output to go up, consumers should spend more and save less. But in the long run, if you want economic output to go up, consumers need to save more and spend less. As we'll see later in the term, that statement is true. Long term versus short term. What's your time horizon that you're worried about? We see this discussion about budget deficits all the time. Do we need to crimp down on the budget deficit today, or do we need to think about it over the next 10 years? Okay. So what are the macroeconomic policies that we can be using in order to achieve whatever it is that we might want to achieve in terms of economic performance? So these policies typically come under the heading of stabilization policies. Because what we're trying to stabilize is the movement of GDP in the short run. We don't want the booms to be too boomy, and we don't want the busts to be too busty, right? That's where we run into real problems. So we've got fiscal policies, monetary policies, international policies, and regulatory policies that we can use. Fiscal policies, as I'm sure you know, are changes in government purchases, or spending, and changes in taxes or tax rates. So just some of the questions, though, that come up about fiscal policy. Do budget deficits matter? Does it matter at all? Can fiscal austerity stimulate economic activity? If so, how does that actually work? And by how much? How much austerity do we need in order to get that stimulus? Now, at least you think this is a throwaway type of question. Those countries the International Monetary Fund, the government in Britain have been following this policy. Robert Rubin, who was President Clinton's Treasury Secretary, just had an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal last week saying, we need to bring the budget deficit down in order to stimulate the economy. There are people who follow that. But maybe it's fiscal expansion that actually stimulates the economy. And again, if so, how does that work? And does it work all the time or only some of the time? Does it matter what the conditions of the economy are? Are we in a deep recession? Or are we in a mild recession? Are we at full employment? Or are we in a boom situation? And what effects do tax rates have? Right? This says increases, but we could think about it as decreases. Yes, it'll change your spendable income, but do they have other effects in terms of willingness to work or willingness to invest that might also influence the size of the labor force? Now, monetary policy, as you know, are the central bank's attempts to change the money supply, short-term interest rates, but also more recently, the size of the central bank's balance sheet. And again, some of the questions we might ask ourselves is, how does the central bank actually do all of those things? How does it affect the money supply? How do changes in the money supply affect economic activity and inflation? Can monetary policy always stimulate an economy or be used to stimulate an economy? Does it matter the state of the economy or the level of interest rates? And what do we do about what is now being called quantitative easing? Changing the size of a central bank's balance sheet without changing the money supply. Any effect? Well, this is an ongoing experiment right now. What are the risks associated with quantitative easing? Janet Yellen, the new chair of the Federal Reserve Board and a Berkeley professor, is going to let us know over the next couple of years. Now, even with monetary and fiscal policy, another aspect of stabilization policy that leads to controversy is the notion of how active or non-active policy should actually be. A Keynesian would argue if you have big fluctuations in economic activity, then you need to have very active monetary and fiscal policy or very active stabilization policies. But a classical economist, John Cochran is an example from the University of Chicago, would argue, no, you don't. The economy has natural self-healing properties associated with it. When you knock it into recession, remember the economy is made up of a bunch of markets. What happens in microeconomics when you knock an economy out of equilibrium? It moves back to equilibrium. Well, if each individual market does that, then the entire economy should be doing that as well. So you don't need to have active monetary and fiscal policy. You can simply let the economy heal on its own. And if you are activist, then you get another slice of the controversy by trying to determine whether that policy should be discretionary or not, where discretionary we mean we're going to let Ben Bernanke and now Janet Yellen decide with a bunch of other boys and girls exactly what monetary policy should do. But they're going to use their best judgment and with their accumulated knowledge and wisdom to figure that out. Or should we have a set of rules that tell us more exactly what to do? How rapidly to grow the money supply? How to set interest rates? How to set changes in government spending or tax rates based on other variables? Can we come up with an equation that would give us more discipline in terms of looking at these kinds of issues, a rule-based activism. We'll need to take a look at that as well. John Taylor, an economist who's over at the Junior University across the bay, has a rule, oddly enough named the Taylor Rule, which actually tries to be activist in setting interest rates, but to set them very specifically according to a particular formula that he devised. Okay, so with all that in mind, let's talk a little bit about the Great Recession and the economic recovery we've seen since then. So this is real GDP. The bars are showing what happened on a quarter-to-quarter basis annualized, and the red line is showing what's happened to GDP on a year-on-year basis. One of the things that you can see is starting in the fourth quarter of 2008, the economy plunged by over 8%. And then in the first quarter of 2009, by another 5%. These were the sharpest back-to-back quarters we had seen in the post-World War II period. This was scary, scary times. But since the middle of 2009, the economy has been recovering. And as we saw earlier, there have been a couple of hiccups along the way where we haven't had very strong growth. But the economy is growing. Now, this particular diagram looks like a bunch of spaghetti thrown against the wall. But what it really is showing the performance of the economy after every recession in the post-World War II period, where this was the peak of the business cycle. So we've got the recessions and then economic expansions. This red line is 2008-09 and since then. Maybe hard to see, but what we saw is for the first three quarters of the recession, it was actually pretty mild. And then after Lehman Brothers failed, the bottom fell out. Eventually, the economy stabilized and it started to grow again. But if you look at this, the gap between even the weakest previous economic expansion and the current one has gotten wider and wider. So by any measure, looking at real GDP, this has been a very deep recession and a very slow economic recovery. This shows the same thing, same types of information, except with the employment. You can see also that during this late 08 and early 09 period, we were losing jobs at a rate of 700,000-800,000 per month. So employers were shedding workers left and right. We did see the losses begin to moderate fairly quickly. This area in here gets messed up because this is census hiring, which was very temporary. But we've basically had modest job gains during the expansion period. This shows the same information that we had for the GDP spaghetti graph, but just looking at employment. Again, what you see is that the recession didn't look anything unusual for the first three quarters. The bottom fell out, and now the gap is still quite wide. But the other thing to notice here, we've never gotten back to where we were. Employment today is below where it was in the fourth quarter of 2007. Even though economic activity has already surpassed that level. Okay, and this is the unemployment rate. So we've already seen the unemployment rate. It's now down to 6.8%. So huge increase, very slow pull down. This is the federal funds rate. This is the short-term interest rate that the central bank controls. And what we saw is starting actually towards the end of 2007, before the recession began, the central bank started cutting interest rates. And then in 2008, they cut them basically to zero. They've been at zero ever since, and they've promised to keep them at zero to the middle of 2015. Maybe longer, but at least till the middle of 2015. Nominal interest rates cannot go below zero. So bringing these interest rates down to where they are, they can't push them any lower. So in addition to that, the central bank has done so-called quantitative easing. The size of the balance sheet at the end of 2007 was $800 billion. You can see in 2008, they ramped that up to about $2.25 billion, left it there for a while, ramped it up to almost 2.9, left it there for a while, and now they've ramped it up to $4 trillion. Huge, huge increase. This is what we call quantitative easing. When we think about government spending as a percent of GDP, you can also see how rapidly it increased in that during that recession. Big increases in unemployment insurance, in food stamp assistance, in other types of income support. It also involved the stimulus package spending. But since early 2010, those numbers have actually started to retreat relative to the size of the economy. Still well above our 20% long-run average, but coming back. Tax receipts had just the opposite. Tax receipts fell with economic activity, and now they're beginning to come back slowly. Still well below their long-term average of 18%. And so the budget's deficit went from 1.5% to 10%, the largest budget deficit since 1945, at the end of World War II. And the debt, or the accumulated deficits, increased very dramatically, from roughly 60% to a little over 100% on one measure, or 35% to 75% on another measure. And what happened to inflation? Well, we've already talked about how oil prices zoomed and then crashed. Oil prices also went up here. But if you look at core inflation, you'll see that there was a modest retreating trend during that entire period. So those are some of the economic variables that we need to be able to develop an economic model for in order to explain. How can we think about the economic crisis without also knowing something about what actually happened? So with just the few minutes that we have left, I want to just talk a few things about the course syllabus. So first of all, our textbook is Frederick Mishkin, Macroeconomics, Policy, and Practice. So there are lots of different versions of this textbook floating around on campus. So the paperback, the softback, is a custom edition which only has the chapters that we're going to use. The hardback edition is perfectly acceptable if you can find it for a cheaper price or steal it, or borrow it from a friend, or find it elsewhere. This book has been used by several professors on campus in previous semesters, so it may have a different cover. It may have a different professor's name on it, Arnold, Hawkins, Fitch, Wood. Oh, that's not different. That's me. But they've all used this book in the past. Still the first edition, so if you find it, you've got it. Okay, in terms of classroom supplies or exam supplies, you will need to get an iClicker, right? iClicker, the old iClickers, iClicker 2, there's an iClicker Plus. I'm told they will all work, but you need to get one of these. Our system does not work with the app that you can put on your phone or tablet or laptop. So get one of these, right? You'll need those. We will start iClicker questions on Thursday. For exams, you will need a yellow highlighter. Please don't come to exams with an orange highlighter and ask if it's okay. Yellow highlighter. Okay? We have multiple choice questions. You will have to highlight your answers in yellow. Okay? You will also need a set of colored pens and or pencils. Black, red, blue, and green. We have lots of diagrams. We shift a lot of curves. Every time you shift a curve, you will be asked to draw it in a new color. That'll help you. makes labeling much easier. It particularly helps your GSIs on grading. So get your set of colored pens and pencils. You'll need that specifically for problem sets and for exams. My office hours are Tuesdays and Thursdays, days that we have classes, the hour before class, 12:45 to 1:45. Takes 15 minutes for me to come down here from Haas, which is where my office is. I'm also available by appointment. However, I am only on campus on Tuesdays and Thursdays, so appointments would have to be either before 9:30 a.m. or after class. But I am available. My email address. Now remember, there's 400 and some odd of you and one of me. Your first point of contact for any questions should be your GSI. It's only if your GSI can't answer a question that you should come to me about class material. Okay, keep in mind that attendance is required for your first two discussion sections. So if you add Tuesday, Thursday discussion sections, that means today and Thursday. If you have Monday, Wednesday discussion sections, it means yesterday. You all went yesterday, right? No. It means tomorrow and next Monday, right? Is required. Make sure you go. Make sure you get signed in. There is excess demand for this course. They will not increase the class size. So if you aren't there, then you are going to get dropped. And if you get dropped, there's absolutely nothing either I or the GSIs can do to get you back in. So you need to be there. Okay, I can't get you in. Okay, any enrollment issues at all, including changing discussion sections, which I suggest that you not even try and do until week two or three or four. Any questions about enrollment should be addressed to the head GSI. She handles all enrollment issues. Professors in the economics department don't deal with them at all. Tablets, laptops, phones, etc. Can only be used in class for classroom purposes. I will, on occasions, walk up and down the aisles. I don't want to see anybody surfing the web. If I do, I will embarrass you in front of the entire class. And if I catch you doing it again, I will confiscate your laptop. It's happened. Five graded assignments. So iClicker quizzes, they will start tomorrow on Thursday, right? So we have something like 23, of which 18 will be counted. So we throw out your lowest five, I think. Problem sets, there will be six. We will count your highest five. Notice that means each problem set is worth 5% of your grade. That means you want to do good work on your problem sets. We'll have three exams, and the exams will have these dates. February 25th, Tuesday, in class. Tuesday, April 8th, in class. And Monday, May 12th, 3 to 6 p.m., somewhere, I'm told, on campus. Right? So those are the exam dates that we'll have. Everything else that's in here we can talk about later. So have a good afternoon, and I will see you on Thursday.